My name is Ann Basie, and this is the session. My series this week is on simple living, asking questions around it, looking for some alternatives. And this session is called Climate Engineering, kind of for dummies, basically. This is our middle session. We kind of had a panel Monday night looking at different people and lifestyle choices. Yesterday, we were looking more at some of the North American values that our structure has been, our society and the structures that we live in were built around, and that make it easier for us to own cars and go to the drive-thru than take the bus or ride a bike or make some other decisions. So that was yesterday. This session, Climate Engineering for Dummies, comes about because I read a quote recently in which a person said, "From here on out, we are all climate engineers. Whatever we do, our decisions, our actions have an effect on the climate." And so this session is just devoted in a non-technical way to kind of understanding our impact on the climate, and then we'll have, I hope, a long discussion about ways we can maybe do things differently. So what I'm going to give you now is a presentation that I heard about a year and a half ago during an Earth Day celebration in Chicago. It was given by a weatherman. He did such a good job of explaining the complex world of climate change that I took notes like crazy. I'm sorry to tell you, I didn't ever catch his name. I can't even give him credit. But the whole structure here is, this is what I'm going to do. But first, I'd like to ask whether anybody has ever heard of the term eco-anxiety. Have you, Clary? Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Can you tell me more about the term eco-anxiety?
No. I just remember seeing that word.
Hearing that word. Okay. This is a kind of a new diagnosis for us, kind of a new condition, a new malaise. Eco-anxiety, defined as pervasive nervousness about global warming, toxins, and environmental destruction, resulting in anxiety and obsessions about saving the planet. It's practically a clinical diagnosis these days. Maybe we'll see it in the next SDM, diagnostic and statistical manual. So I think what this term acknowledges is that we're very anxious about the state of the environment and we don't know what to do. So today, my little lecture is the beginning, I hope, of sort of a cure for us in understanding more about our impact on the environment and seeing what we can do in the future, maybe lessening our anxiety, our eco-anxiety. So here's what the weatherman told me and 50 other people, and I have to check my notes. He said, first of all, climate is defined by weathermen who make things, tough things simple for people, as the long-term average weather conditions of a region. Weather is the state of the atmosphere at a specific place and time. Right now in Holden, it's a beautiful day. It's feeling a little more like September, don't you think? It's kind of, you can just tell it's over the hump of the summer. That's weather. So this is long-term weather patterns. This is specific weather. Climate change, he said, is change in long-term statistics about the weather. This is what puts us to sleep, because we think, how are we going to understand that? You know, when it kind of comes out in statistical modules, we don't get that. But he said, what we do understand as humans living on a planet is climate variability. What we can observe is what's different about the weather we've experienced and the weather patterns that we've been living through in the last 10 or 20 years. And that's where we can kind of see what our impact has been. So he, as a weatherman, was talking about some of the patterns. Again, this was a presentation in Chicago, so these are mostly Northern Illinois explanations and examples. But feel free to add some in. He pointed out that in Northern Illinois, for a few years up in Chicago and Northern Illinois, we weren't getting a lot of snow. Now the snow's back. But what happens now that's different is that we have four different snowfalls and four different complete melt-offs. So it's not like the snow falls on January 1st and is there until February 28th. It starts earlier, it melts before Christmas, it snows again, it melts again, it snows again, it melts again. And that's happening in a lot of places, I think, in the West, and it's very bad for reservoirs and flood control. That, you know, when you can't count on the snow to stay there and then melt nice and slowly and fill the reservoir, you get floods and low reservoirs later. He was very concerned about tornadoes because he said, as a weatherman, you know, he has been seeing tornadoes in January. He said, something is not right when you see a tornado deposit debris on snow and frozen lakes. It's not a season when we're supposed to see tornadoes. and he is a weatherman in the Midwest, is covering more tornadoes there. In Illinois, we get a lot less ice on Lake Michigan, which means higher lake temperature, which means more evaporation, and it's really dropping. It's quite a lot. He said, in the past 3 decades, the rate of warming in the global temperatures has been 3 times greater than the whole of the previous century. Past 30 years, 3 times greater, and these are the hottest years on record, and you can just see that all of them started in 1995. So, according to him, as a weatherman, it's really happening. So he wasn't too interested in arguing with scientists or politicians over whether or not this is climate change. He said, no, we're seeing enough patterns, we're seeing enough heat, that we are seeing changes. So then he did this little math here, which was the easiest math I've ever seen about global warming. Okay, just get this right. Remember, I was an English major. Okay, 7 billion tons of CO2. This is what we are emitting every year right now. 3 billion tons of CO2 is what the Earth is designed to absorb through ocean sinking, through forests. That's so the natural capacity of Earth to absorb it is 3 billion. So that's 4 billion tons extra that we're emitting right now.
Not good.
No, not good. And then here are the sources. So it's interesting then to kind of, you know, the other problem with statistics is you just can't tell sometimes where to start. Everything sounds so important. What do? So these are dire numbers, but here are the sources. So coal-fired electricity and industry give off 3 billion tons. Transportation, cars, trucks, ocean liners, trains, do 1.5 billion tons. Methane, released by landfills and agriculture, I'm just going to write here lots because I didn't get that number. And deforestation will write lots too. Here's where I stopped being a scientist. Apparently, deforestation adds up to, because we are losing forests and lowering the Earth's ability to absorb the CO2, that ends up being a contributing factor. So Greenpeace says 32 million acres of trees and plants are lost to deforestation every year, and the cleaning and burning of tropical forests contributes up to 20% of the carbon pollution. So these are here are easy terms. Here's our calendar. Here's our easy math for second graders, and here's our breakdown of where it's coming from. A few more things that he mentioned were that he would say, okay, go ahead and debate it, but he would say, like, weather people would agree that there's a 90% chance that the heat-trapping pollution that we produce since 1950 is the main factor, the main reason why this is happening. And if we are not able to kind of make our lives less fuel-intensive, less CO2 intensive, then the Earth, this is where it starts to get really scary, will warm by 4 to 11 degrees. So he said, if there is no change here, Northern Illinois, where I was living, maybe you'll recognize this, Claire, he said, in 100 years with no change, the climate in Northern Illinois will be like the climate of East Texas today, which is a big change. And the Great Lakes would be 4 or 5 feet lower, and that would basically stop shipping on the Great Lakes because that would go beneath, you know, or else they'll have to make very shallow draft boats to go through the locks at Sault Ste. Marie. So, this is
a 100-year prediction?
100-year prediction. Okay. Remember, I'm quoting a weatherman from a lecture I went to. I'm not a scientist.
Would you like some information from an oceanographer? Not me.
From a what?
An oceanographer.
Yeah.
Because I talked to one once,
yeah.
And I said, okay, tell me the truth about this. And he'd been studying it since he was in college, and now it's professional. And what he said is, the other part, if you look back in fossil record, there were 2 times when climate change was like a spike. In 10 years, there was an enormous said, we don't have enough data to know how to predict those. But the possibility is the one there, you've got methane lots.
Yeah.
Your sources were landfills and agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
And you said the problem and the thing that could make for such a spike is a positive feedback loop.
Yeah.
And the one that he thought most people were worried about, maybe beyond redemption, is that the permafrost in the Arctic releases methane.
Methane.
And as Earth warms, there's an enormous amount of methane in the bottom of the ocean.
Yeah.
And every little bubble brings up more.
Yeah.
And he said that's the scenario that could in fact lead to a spike. So this whole change happens in not centuries, but maybe decades.
Ocean bubbles and permafrost. You put that down?
Yep.
Can't believe I'm doing this so calmly.
And the thing about it is that each one of those makes, I mean, methane's actually worse than CO2, and they feed back positively because a little bit of more permafrost melts.
Creates more.
And a little more warming of the ocean, more methane's released. And so instead of having something that holds equilibrium, in fact,
it
just
it
the
escalates.
Cycle getting worse and worse.
Did you have a question, sir?
No, I just wanted to say that I read recently in the newspaper that Barack Obama has ordered that 18 million acres of new forest be planted in the United States.
That's a good measure.
Yeah, that's about the size of West Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
Just to fill in the blanks, if they're right on the 20%, why don't you put tentatively 1.4 for methane, you're getting close to your 7. If you,
so if we just divide that, you mean?
No, I'd say 20% of 7 billion would be 1.4.
Thank you. Okay.
And it's close to the significance of transportation, which I find scary.
Yeah. Well, you know, we might be able to do something about this, and we might not be able to do something about that. I mean, if there's a fast spike, maybe it's all over. But, I mean, I know I'm a Pollyanna, and I go through life acting as if it mattered what I did, and I am hoping that other people will pick up that attitude. So I guess I would say, regardless of the results, I know that I would like to figure out ways to live in a less carbon-dependent society. So, what this, going back here to what the weatherman said, actually up here, as oceans warm, they are less able to absorb CO2. Okay, but Steve Kramer, who's the new utilities guy, he's the one who's almost 7 feet tall, you can, you know who he is. So he said, this may be bad scientist, but he had read that actually ameliorating action would be if we painted all flat roofs white, then it greatly increases the reflective power of the earth, and that would maybe help. So he said, he can't give us any scientific sources, but we'll get down to what in just a minute. So there's one. Paint roofs white?
That's starting to be done.
My house in Chicago, my building had a bitumen roof that was white reflected back. And they were doing roof gardens and stuff. So a few more points that the weatherman made, and then we can maybe look at some of these. We can have our conversation. To avoid this scenario, presuming our actions have effect, people are saying that we have to cut emissions worldwide by half. Actually, you'd think we'd have to go slightly more than that if it's because we're already 0.5 over. But anyway, we'll say by half. But to be fair, to live with justice, the United States has to cut it back by 60-80% because we are the people who have put this out there. So it's a justice issue, and so our lifestyle has to really be examined more. And it's not, again, like we're going to go back to matches and bicycles. We can do a lot of change, I think, and still have a lot of comfort. And a lot of people, I always feel good about this, a lot of people are out there now putting a lot of energy into this. This is a field that's getting a lot. Peter Mercer Taylor, who's teaching the musicology classes, his wife Beth is now like the kind of coordinator, maybe dean, but not called that, of a sustainability program, an interdisciplinary sustainability program at the University of Minnesota that's drawing from many different sciences to pull together a program, because everybody's agreeing that this doesn't belong to one discipline. This is something that the whole earth has to get behind. When I was here, when I heard, first started to learn about global warming about 9 years ago, in a session here at Holden that was led by a man named Dave Carlson, who was from the, is it the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Center? It's in Boulder, Colorado. So the one good thing he said about this was, you know, global warming presents an opportunity for international cooperation. So if we look at it that way, maybe that's something we can respond to. Yesterday when we were talking about values and structure, I mentioned that Carl Jung said there's problems, the worst problems are insoluble. You can't solve the worst problems. You can only outgrow them. And the way to outgrow them is to think, is to agree on a higher or a greater good. That changes perspective, and then there's something different to do about what you thought was a problem. So perhaps we'll see unparalleled levels of international cooperation. I don't know that we're encouraged so far, but it's a pretty dire picture. So then the weatherman went on to say, if these are the four areas of the greatest impact, what then would be the four areas in which we could respond that would have the greatest impact? And again, a lot of, you know, scientific data, you just don't know where to start. So he said, energy efficiency and conservation could lead to up to 40% of the savings that we have to make. So even changing light bulbs matters. What did I say? Conservation. And he pointed out, I remember Dave Carlson saying years ago, really, compared to 100 years ago, our economy is much less carbon dependent than it was. Every year, the amount of carbon and coal fuel, fossil fuels it takes to run the U.S. economy gets smaller and smaller. And our energy gets more and more efficient. The problem is, every year we come up with more ways to use that energy. So we are way more efficient than we used to be, and we've used up all that efficiency on new gadgets and things to run with electricity. So our cell phone chargers are, I keep forgetting to unplug my computer here. I should do that. All of the things that sleep instead of go off and have remote controls that are consuming energy around the clock, those are things that we've done. So this is a very important area for us to look at. Jared Diamond, who has done a lot of writing, says that per capita oil consumption in Western Europe is half of North American consumption, but living standards there equal or exceed ours. So it's not necessarily true that cutting this by 40 or 50% cuts into comfort. It leads us to another way to live, but it's not necessarily less comfortable. Building better cars and a public transportation system could be 25%. Here, let's go like this, 40%, 25%. Better cars and public transportation. I don't know where you got these figures. Renewable energy and biofuel could be another 20%. And removing carbon from fossil fuels, like maybe not using coal, no carbon-based, how do you say that, based fossil fuels, if that ended, that would be another 15%. But it's interesting, isn't it, how that's actually the lowest? So changing the fuel, well, if you add up to that comes up to 35%, which is almost as much. So saving the energy and changing the fuel and increasing transportation opportunities or alternatives would end up having quite a big impact. Anybody have any reactions so far? Or no? Just go have them open the scotch and make it a double? I'll start with Walt and then go to you, Walt.
I just while I was here, read an article in the National Geographic. Six months. We'll talk about start at your home.
Kind of starting at what?
Start at your home.
Start at your home?
Energy saving at your home. But there was a graph that showed what the energy efficiency would be of various things. And obviously the coal fire, the efficiency and the conservation is the biggest item. It said the transportation is the most expensive to fix.
Is it? That's interesting.
Yeah. By a long shot. other things, the efficiency stuff actually saves you money.
Yeah.
In the long run. So.
Could I ask a question on dovetailing on that? Most expensive to fix, what if we did get more public transportation, like trains or buses or whatever? I'm very rural and
the cost
of getting that going.
It's the cost of putting together the rail and the transportation.
Buses and.
You know, building hydrogen fuel cell cars. Until somebody can figure out how to build them like a Model T, it's gonna be really expensive.
Expensive.
So there's.
But isn't that our only hope, or wouldn't that be something to really, what do we do?
You know, I also read an article that said if you could change your gas mileage from 30 to 35 miles to the gallon, it does almost as the same amount.
Amount, okay. Sir?
Okay, do you think that wind and solar and geothermal and hydroelectric could replace carbon fuels?
Well, I guess it has a 20% impact. I guess that's a question we'll have to let the scientists decide. I mean, here, you know, in the Northwest, there's always a lot less coal dependency because there's wind farms and hydroelectric. It would be great, but I know I'm, as a scientist, sounds good to me is all I would say. Do you have any insights into that, whether it would have any impact?
No, I mean, are there any other sources of renewable energy than those? That
wind, geothermal, solar?
That is, nuclear is not the best. And
which one?
Nuclear isn't on the list, but when you say no carbon-based fossil fuel, isn't that overlap with renewable energy
biofuel?
It does,
you'd think, right,
And so that's called double counting, I think.
Yeah,
I don't
maybe.
Know that we'll get away with
creating,
getting 35% out of
maybe
carbon.
Maybe he's thinking creating new sources
yeah.
and removing carbon from other sources. Is it possible to have a fossil fuel that's not carbon-based? It doesn't sound to me like, they sort of sound like
well,
they're... I mean, usually
some people think that's a scam, actually.
Taking out carbon?
Well, that doing it uses more energy than it saves. And so, you know, a lot of that is a
true for those biofuels, for a lot of them, it does.
Yeah.
What about the play of the internet as far as saving people from commuting or these kinds of things? Is that saving? Or what I read recently is the mainframes holding all this information. It's just like an electrical, it's going to heading towards an electrical disaster. Because there's so much like Facebook and YouTube, it's just like this huge electrical.
Bandwidth. When will bandwidth stop?
So is that...
These are questions we're asking, okay? Sorry, it's like, I think what you're doing is pointing new places for me to read and think, and for all of us to read and think. Okay, we'll go to you.
Well, just on the transportation, the question was, how do you react? I'm in total pessimism as I look at that.
Yeah.
And then we had an experience out in Seattle in 1968, people voted down a proposal for mass transit.
Mm-hmm.
And mass transit is expensive in the West because we don't have passenger lines built in like New York and Boston.
Mm-hmm.
And over a series of elections in the, I guess this decade, the public will reluctantly approve and complain about the expense and just argue, but they seem to have a sense that there's a greater good here and that they ought to be willing to tax themselves.
Mm-hmm.
It's extremely expensive, of course.
But now you're getting light rail to the airport?
Yeah, we got a new route. Yeah, it'll be out to the airport within a year or so.
It's coming.
Within a year.
Wow.
Yeah, it's,
I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah. And it's clean. It's just amazing.
Uh-huh. I grew up in Sacramento, and I was very proud that they were, like 20 years ago, they were already on the light rail thing. You still need connecting bus lines. It's the same in Chicago. We have trains that go everywhere, but you have to take buses between them. It's not like New York City where it's train.
But it's not something where people within a few weeks get, I see it and get excited and everybody's in line. It just doesn't seem to happen.
Yeah. It's a behavior change for us, which was sort of like yesterday with our values of, you know, convenience and independence. You know, you get somewhere quickly and by yourself when you want to.
Yeah.
That's not the culture of public transportation. So it's going to be a shift for us. And, you know, maybe maybe people aren't gonna go, I mean, I don't have a car, that was one of my choices, but I did that slowly. This may be the second time for some of you hearing that. It took me a while to learn how to live without a car. First, I shared with a neighbor. We did not see eye to eye over how to maintain a car and keep it properly licensed. And after I was the one pulled over for driving her car that she'd lost a sticker for and wasn't concerned about, and I spent the 2 months going to court, then I said, let's be friends and not share your car. But then from that, it's, you know, that sort of helped wean me. But it was a long process of setting up alternatives. It wasn't, you can't really say, great, hooray, I'm car free, without putting a whole lot of thought into it. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, I think it can work, but it's a really a different way, especially if you had to put a lot of thought into it because we don't have 100% service when we leave our cars, so yeah. We really have to think hard. Getting back to the notion of eco-anxiety, when I was first reading about this, I thought, well, okay, here's my plan for overcoming eco-anxiety. The first would be, you know, we're members of the church. Every Sunday we have corporate confession. First we have to say, I confess. I'm implicated here. It's easy to feel scared about climate change and overwhelmed by statistics, but when they get this clear, then you can just kind of see where you are in this and know that we're culpable. In carbon footprinting, I was thinking, hey, I don't have a car, great. But until now, I've lived in Illinois. It's almost coal and nuclear. There's, you know, my carbon footprint is much higher than I would expect it would be because the built-in cost of heating your home in the Midwest, the carbon cost is high because it's not hydroelectric or solar or wind. Or we don't get any of that. ComEd has like 0.1% other, it says, which they're thinking about growing, but they don't know how to do it yet. So confessing and taking responsibility, I think, is a good first step. The second would be understanding our own power and influence. When I was talking on yesterday, and again, forgive me if you've heard this before, but I was talking about how a year ago I was invited into the conversation at the ELCA churchwide building to help make it greener, and I was really frustrated by that conversation. It had a good outcome. Partly I was frustrated because we were trying to change a building and 450 people, and not just me and my perfect little life, you know. It was a task of a different dimension. But partly it was like nobody could figure out who had the power to make these changes. All these people say, well, it's not me. I'm not the one who can do that. I thought, you know, you're some pretty high up people in this organization. What do you mean you don't have the power? But after we figured it out and decided who would be accountable for it and how that would be made accountable and who was going to report to who, then things were a lot easier. Then we understood institutionally how to make it happen. But I think besides denial of responsibility, I think sometimes we deny our influence and we say, well, that will make a difference. So I think we should accept our power and our influence and our ability and the impact of our actions and the impact of changing them. Also, it'd be good if maybe we could be more compassionate with ourselves by understanding we're sort of in between lenses. You know, with yesterday we talked about individuality. What were my three? Sorry. Individuality, convenience, value. As a society, we have made convenience one of our greatest goods. We've made economic growth another great good. And then the individual generally comes out over the group. And that's had dynamics in how we've set up our systems. Maybe that's changing as we understand that we do have to cooperate. We have to figure out, first of all, what it means to be sustainable. We have to figure out how to create systems that do things differently. And so maybe our lens is gradually changing, and to be compassionate to ourselves, like instead of me getting all upset at my former coworkers, understand that change is slow and we're sort of in between this lens right now. Maybe someday we'll be the beneficiaries of a lot of great thinking and we'll live inside a system where all of the way we heat our houses, the way we use our energy, the way we move around the world really has a smaller impact. Meanwhile, I think we can live towards it. Yes, sir.
Well, I'm interested that nuclear energy isn't on the list.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering whether it was that, what the 15% solution was supposed to be, the no carbon-based fossil fuel.
Yeah, I think it's hiding somewhere in there. I don't know.
Because it's kind of like training, okay, if you have a climate problem that's happening relatively soon,
yeah,
even if you're starting a nuclear fuel waste problem, that is a very long-term one.
Is it better to do this?
Maybe trading something for sooner and worrying about the long-term might be worth it almost.
Maybe. This is where I'm out of my depth, but that's an interesting idea. Well.
This answers the question about can renewable energy actually meet the demands. The answer is yes. There was a New York Times article about 9 months ago where they said, yes, you could. There's only two problems. One, there's no way to store the energy, so most renewable sources are on demand kind of thing.
Yeah.
If the sun's shining, it's going to work.
Uh-huh.
There's no good way to store it right now. And the second is the disruption of our economy by taking us off the carbon-based fuels.
Right. And that's where this guy, Dave, you know, eight years ago said, the thing is that the impact is going to be a lot less than we think, because every single day people are figuring out how to get out of that. There will be some impact. But like compared to 100 years ago or even 50, would have been terrible. Okay, no way to store renewable energy is sort of on demand. Was that it?
Mm. Right.
And then disruption of economy. I'll just write these things down. So
I'm interested in a comment. It just hit me like a thunderbolt. You're describing the staff meeting at a 450-person operation, and many of us, like me, that's the thing I hate about organizations, staff meeting. People want to be out doing ministry and ministry.
Right, exactly.
But do you think, based on that experience, that maybe that's part of the cost to get people to think differently?
Mm-hmm.
They've got to sit 3 or 4 times over 6 months or a year and hear the same message again until they're just antsy about it? Because it seems like such a waste of time. If you study it and you think, why doesn't everybody all of a sudden agree with you?
Yeah.
But there's something about human nature and our culture that makes it difficult.
It's slow and it's frustrating. And I wouldn't say, you know, these weren't staff meetings. These were like, there had been this green environmental volunteer team that got together and did stuff. And then people were figuring out, you know, none of us is being released from our time to do this. It has very little impact, and we're marginalized. So the question was, how do you bring this more into where the power was? And that's why the question was, where is the power? Is this the office of the secretary, the office of the bishop, who, church and society? I mean, there's a few different ways to do it. So what ended up happening was that the people who are, it's management services, who represents the management company that manages the building, because they're the ones who control garbage pickup, you know, ordering supplies, Office Depot. So actually that was it turned out to be the natural place. Not the, you know, as people of the church, you know, we might think it's all church and society. Let's talk about actions and ministry and use theology. But the people who are making the purchases actually have a big center of influence. But it's slow. I wouldn't say that everybody in the building is getting it. That's why I said, you know, I was also irritable a year ago, because I would be picking up garbage from and putting it into the recycling, and that's a slow change. The simple thing of just telling everybody in the building, from now on there's only two-sided printing, they've decided to let unit by unit implement, and so some people's computers are set up for two-sided printing and others aren't. So they're really, maybe it's because we're nice and we don't want to just do this to each other, but I think in the corporate world, I'm describing, you know, a visionary, a church organization that's visionary, but we're a church instead of a for-profit business, so things kind of get enacted more slowly in terms of the workforce. I'm sure that Coca-Cola has the world's largest program to, you know, buy recycled paper, print two-sided, get rid of everything. They probably are all over it because they know what the benefit is to them. So it's happening, but it's a frustrating, slow change. It's happening.
We're probably lucky in Western Washington. We got an Episcopal bishop that was trained by the Al Gore thing to give a climate change.
That's right.
Well, that's right.
Right from the top.
Well, then he could use that power to change the structure that reports to him. So, I don't know if any of you are in organizations where you have some say, or, you know, just check out and see what's happening. What's happening in your organization?
Off the top of your head, do you know of some website or something? I'm thinking of, in our little town, the high school kids who drive to work and they live to school and they live one block away. It's the image. It's that. I need my truck and my wheels to be a man. I'm sorry, but it just irks me that.
So you're
nobody. I'm thinking if there would be a really even fun program for our high school kids, if I talked to the teachers, said, let's guys, or even at our youth group at church, incentive to think differently, to give them rewards for trying
Good.
Something and make it look like this is a cool thing to do.
To do.
There's school buses paid for, but you're not cool if you're riding a school bus, you gotta drive in. Because, well, I might have something after school too that I need to, you know, work out.
My sister and brother-in-law in California have the same thing. They live in a community with complete bus service and everybody drives their SUVs. So like my sister and brother-in-law are the only ones that walk to the corner and put their kids in the bus and wave. Well, maybe one day a week they have to get picked up, but it's a service that's being provided for you. You're still ignoring it. Has anybody read the work of Shane Claiborne? Do you know Shane Claiborne? He's in the bookstore. Shane Claiborne is a young man, probably he's around 30. He's a very magnetic, hip person for young people. And his book in the bookstore is called The Irresistible Revolution. Kind of looks like it's in brown paper. Someone said, hey, Ann, your book kind of looks like The Irresistible Revolution.
Yeah.
That was a compliment. He lives in an intentional community in Philadelphia called The Simple Way. And he's just somebody who decided to take Christianity seriously, and he and his group just, they're always doing stuff that's 100% gospel and 100% not cool to mainstream culture, but he makes it very cool. So he has a big following. So Shane Claiborne, he's probably on YouTube, this Irresistible Revolution, it's written for younger people, and he's kind of like a young person who would say, nobody ever... He's sort of a naive about the gospel that, you know, nobody ever said it wasn't cool to take this seriously and live it out. And so it's taken him and his community to some pretty, what we in the mainstream church society would think of as extreme, but very prophetic places. So he's talked about simple living as well. Otherwise, you know,
you
said the word fun. I don't know where the fun is in this. Where there are some...
I just can picture...
Reward system.
Keeping track of stuff and even cutting out some unhealthy stuff that they're. We just got back from a trip with these boys and it's Mountain Dew every 5 minutes.
Every 5 minutes.
Sorry.
Somebody was
there's got to be something here that relates to
Mountain Dew. That's another. Somebody mentioned last week, Thomas Friedman's book, Flat, Hot, and Crowded. So I can't remember the word that he looked at. He said one good thing that the United States has in its favor is that we are an extremely competitive society. So if we all got into decarboning, he had another term for it, to de something, and that if that became, if we linked these goals with our competitive nature, we would really race ahead. And there is already, I have this little handout that I was going to pass out Friday, but you're welcome. It's my Ann Basie's Guide to Simplicity and Sustainability on one simple sheet of paper with a lot of interesting links. There is a place, www.carbonrally.com, which is like a place for offices to get together and report their greening efforts and compete with each other. So, you could pit accounting against sales, against marketing, or, in a town, you could have 10 companies competing with each other to see who's going most green. www.carbonrally. So maybe that's an interesting thing to watch out for. Where are the ways in which, maybe it's going to be the Super Bowl of avoiding global warming. Maybe we'll have some national competition. That would be really interesting. And be 100% us, right? We're good at that.
Yeah.
Yes.
There's a website called Kilowatt.
Kill a what?
Kilowatt.
Like what it sounds like, kill?
A what? It's a young man that lived in Tennessee. They figured out that each household in the United States on average consumes 5 tons of coal.
Mm-hmm.
And gives you simple reasons, simple things to just make your house more energy efficient.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So.
I think probably energy efficiency in our homes is a really good place to start, in our offices. Those are places where we have spheres of influence. Congregations too. We'll talk more about that Friday or Saturday. But congregations, my congregation decided they did a big values clarifying exercise to create a new mission statement and put something at the center. And so it's something like Unity Lutheran Church is an urban green community where Christ's love is shared through acts of, and it goes on from there. Urban green space. That was the term. All of a sudden now we have something to measure ourselves against. So when one day somebody said, Sexton needs a bunch more stuff and we're going to get Lysol, you know, the disinfectant. Then the next day somebody said, but if we're in urban green space, maybe we should be looking into alternative cleaning things. So having made that our part of our mission statement means that every single time people suggest something, someone says, does that fit with it? So we're back to glass communion cups and people to wash them. There are no more styrofoam, we have paper, and then people have mugs. But people have been a lot better at just, I'm getting back to waste now, but somewhere in this, it's all related to me. So congregations are other places where we have impact and influence and can make changes. Mark?
Speaking of waste, Seattle tried to pass that bag law of 20 cents for plastic or paper bags and trying to help people going into bringing their own canvas bags, which unfortunately didn't pan through.
Last week somebody was saying they had called it the bag tax, so they were noting the way that in which the message frames it.
Absolutely.
So by calling it a bag tax, that basically ensured its defeat, right?
I heard that the plastics industry pumped millions.
I threw in like 300,000.
So on the radio, you
just
never
in
heard
Washington,
anything.
Yeah.
Bigger,
but this is interesting. According to something I read, this is a little recycled card. Said in January 2003, Taiwan decided to fine businesses that give away plastic bags and utensils or styrofoam food containers. You could buy them for 3 cents a piece, but if it were given away, the vendor got fined. So between January 2003 and June of 2004, the use of plastic shopping bags dropped by 69%. Plastic tableware pretty much disappeared, and the total amount of garbage in Taiwan was reduced by 25%. So that's interesting. But that's a very, you know, small, highly urban island like Manhattan. And so I wonder, somehow, the greater good or the Taiwan government overruled the plastic. But that, if that's true, that's huge. Look at the impact of that.
There's a program coming out of the National Episcopal Church led by a former bishop of Alaska that is designed to, over 15 years to 10 years or something, to reduce carbon in the churches, synagogues, and mosques of America by 50%, and giving instructions on conversion of old equipment and that sort of thing. It's going to be heavily supported, to the extent that any church has money to support anything nowadays.
Right.
So the name escapes me for a moment, but it's got
Genesis
its own.
Covenant,
Genesis
Covenant.
Genesis Covenant, yeah.
Yeah.
And you can just Google that.
Thank you.
And
yeah,
we'll
that'd be fun.
Last week also somebody said, so, you know, what about population explosion? Surely that's an impact here. Well, this is getting back to Jared Diamond, who writes all those great books about, you know, guns, germs, and steel, and this and that. So this was interesting. Jared Diamond said, this is in the New York Times, January of 2008, that total world consumption is a key figure in this. So North America, Western Europe, Japan, and Australia consume resources like oil and metals and produce wastes like plastic and greenhouse gases at a rate that's 32 times higher than the developing world. So if there's a billion people in developed countries, that's multiply that times 32 is 32. If there's 5 billion in the developing world and you multiply that times one, or by one, that's 5. So Kenya maybe has their relative per capita consumption rate is 1 on this scale. They have 30 million people, so 30 times 1 is 30 million. But if you take the 300 million in North America times 32, then you'd see we consume like 320 times more than Kenyans do. So it's interesting to say, while population growth strains natural resources, the people who are really doing the strain of natural resources are us. Of course, in places where there are no alternatives to trees, deforestation is a problem. Stove fuel is a tough problem for some developing world countries. Then it said, if India and China catch up, to our consumption, and here we are saying everybody should live like us, then the world consumption rates will triple. But if the whole world's consumption rates, oh, wait a minute, if the whole world's consumption rates increase 11-fold, anyway, it's more math. But just so, again, this is just, I forget it down there, I shouldn't have written that down. But looking at relative impact, I think population is a factor, but our own consumption and waste production is different. Walt, can you tell us about your church's solar panel roof and how that works?
We had about, let's see, two years ago, the pastor asked me if I would lead up a project to put solar panels on the south side of our church. I didn't know anything about solar energy and solar panels at the time, but said I would do it. In Wisconsin, there's an organization called Focus on Energy. Every time we pay our energy bills, 1.5 cents of every dollar goes to Focus on Energy. 10% of their budget is to encourage renewable energy sources. They have a budget this year of $100 million, so they've got $10 million that they can give out on renewable energy projects. And a portion of that is designated for not-for-profit. So they came and they did an audit for us of the church, and they suggested lots of different things, including changing light bulbs and all of those kinds of things. We Energies, which is our public utility, actually contributed about $12,000 worth of light bulbs. We converted all the light bulbs in the church to fluorescent, low energy use light bulbs. Changed our, well, how should I put this? We were looking at a solar, they also suggested that we could put solar hot water panels on one section of the church, and we could also put solar panels on another to generate electricity. The solar hot water never turned out to be efficient because we were going to heat some water that gets used, hot water gets used once a week. It was going to cost us more to store the hot water than it was going to be, than it was actually worth. But the solar energy, they're willing, Focus on Energy was willing to contribute $2 for every kilowatt hour we could generate. We're currently generating 2,800 kilowatt hours. It's not a real big system. It's a 10-panel system. When we started the project, it was about 2% of our total consumption in the church. This church is a 1950s cathedral, is the best way to describe it. What big ceilings looks like a cathedral. With our energy efficiency, now the solar panels are contributing about 5% to the consumption that we use. And we're fortunate in that the utility was willing to buy the power for us at about twice what we were actually paying for power. So it's a net plus to us. Focus on Energy paid for part of it. The energy company paid for 40% of it. They paid for 20% of it. The energy company paid 40%, and then we had to contribute the 40%. We had a member who thought it was important, so she gave us the money that we needed. It was about a $25,000 system, so we got it all put together. But the biggest impact, and you can't, if you look at the economics of doing all of this, you can't, it's a long payback because it's expensive. But it's 2.5 tons of CO2 a year.
Oh, we'll take it out.
There you go.
All right.
And more important to us is we're right smack in the middle of the central city of Milwaukee. If you want to think of what some of the toughest neighborhoods in Milwaukee are, just think about where our Saviors is. It's a statement to the community that we are going to stay there, we will be there, and it's important to us.
How have people in the congregation been affected by that in their personal lives? Like, is anybody saying, I mean, is there a fervor to save energy and, you know, conserve and be more efficient?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because when we first started talking about putting the solar panels up, everybody looked at the economics and said, you'll never be able to make any money. And about the same time, we have what we call a Care of Creation Committee, and they recommended eliminating styrofoam cups and using, using just coffee cups, regular coffee as people got more excited about the, you know, in the solar panels, we have this huge statue of the inviting Christ on the front of the, on the south face of our church, which is where the panels would have to go. So the biggest question became, where do you put the panel so it doesn't look like you have the electric Jesus?
Maybe he had got more.
Or that he's got a hat on.
Or that he's got
an
electric.
But Jesus with wings.
Jesus.
Yeah, really wings. Really.
So what did you do?
My wife and I were coming back from Arizona. I said, you know, we're going to build the electric Jesus. But anyway, so actually a member of the congregation said, well, you know, put it at the bottom of the faith, the bottom of the church. Or bottom of the statue, and actually it looks like all we did was put awnings on the front of the church. It looks like they're up about 30 feet. And they actually look very attractive. One lady said, you know, she'd be in favor of it, but she wanted beige panels. And I said, no, that's not going to work. They only come in one color. But as, since we've put the panels up, there's a couple of things that have happened in the congregation. One is people want to know if we can put more up. Another thing is the other aspects of saving energy in the church have taken have risen. Mm-hmm. The building and grounds committee actually thinks about this now. They hadn't thought about it before. And the coffee cup issue got solved by, they said, everybody's got a cup collection, right? They said, why don't you all bring in your favorite cups? Mm-hmm. Now, you know, and so we all contributed our cups. We now have all these extra cups in the back of the church. But every Sunday they come out, we serve the coffee. It's Mount Nehru coffee, but it's a different story. anyway, and so people felt like they contributed something to it because they contributed the coffee cups.
Is your church on the web?
We are. It's Our Savior's Lutheran Church.
Come on.
It's,
is that Saviors with a U in it?
It's OSLC Milwaukee.
Oh, that's easy. Good, I don't have to remember SLC. OSLC Milwaukee.
Our Saviors Lutheran Church.
Well,
.org?
Actually, it's MLW.org. Sorry.
No one can ever find a Lutheran church on the web because we do this anyway. Sorry. Okay, that sounds so old. Our Savior's to me.
You'll see a picture of, it's MILW.
MILW.
Yeah.
Could you have actually raised money if you didn't have that donor? Was there enough interest to fund it if you hadn't had some?
I think we could have. We could have. Yeah, there's enough of us in the congregation that were interested in doing it. But, I mean, it's also raised part of it. Part of the energy company says, we will give you this money if you raise the awareness of people, of the congregation. If you go to that website right now, there's a link that will tell you how much power we're generating and how much power we generated on a daily basis, how much we're currently generating.
We better do that on housework.
Yeah, and the interesting piece of that is the software that does that. It's an internet-based. It's called Fats Manual. But it works. I mean, it's cool. The energy company had no way of monitoring all of their renewable energy sources. They were helping pay for all of these. So they said, we'll hire this company on this web-based company to go in and put the monitoring in all the systems. So
it's a great story about your church. I wonder whether when you talk about the young people in your town or your church, I mean, the people who said in my church, bring back ceramic coffee mugs, were people who'd never washed a dish in their life because their mothers and grandmothers had been doing it. They were so young. So they had all the energy in the world to wash again. So, and they were the ones who just naturally said, why aren't you doing this? Why aren't you doing this? And plastic bottles, which now are banned at ELCA churchwide headquarters, although that's inconsistently implemented because, again, it's top-down. Not everybody at the bottom remembers that. But there's a young woman who got a job about a year ago who basically said to Human Resources, you know, I almost didn't take the job because you offered me a plastic water bottle when I came to the interview, and I couldn't believe that my church would do that. I mean, so the perceptions, look at how old we are in this room, just know that the perceptions are very different among people who are much younger, and that this is a much more logical thing. So I wonder whether that's there's some energy there you can work with. Just, are we getting close to the end? Someone want to tell me?
Order up.
Okay, then in 5 minutes, let me just say a couple things. Of course, I didn't bring any of my sheets to talk about carbon footprinting, but it's very easy to go on the web and calculate your carbon footprint. Travel is an interesting area. You know, while in Alita, you know, pretty much every time you fly to Arusha, you're canceling out your solar roof. You know? I mean, it's travel is a big thing. Last week, somebody had a son, somebody who came to this session had a son who worked for the airline industry and confirmed that they're working very, very hard to try to come up with fuels for airlines that will not be fossil-based. They're looking at everything, but it's not going to happen right away. So meanwhile, we do have to think about how we're using our miles. In general, I think the line is, for example, do you know about the wine line in the United States? If you live Ohio or east, there's less carbon involved in drinking wine from France. If you're west of Ohio, yeah, I do, it's very important. Well, I have friends in New York City who are from, you know, Washington, California, and it's hard for them to do that, but okay. So there's a line, and someone has calculated it.
So if you're west.
West of Ohio, so I think in both cases, Claire, you're on the California or Washington side. But so people are really, they're beginning to make this whole calculation of carbon footprint quite a science. And so there's increasing agreement that if you're traveling less than 500 miles, try not to take an airplane. Try to use some kind of intercity transportation. In Europe, you know, that's one of their strengths. There's so many more intercity alternatives that so they could more easily get rid of intercity airplanes. So that would be one thing. I heard an interesting, I heard a really interesting phrase from a woman who works for the Canadian Churches Board on Global Emissions that we work with at the ELCA, who used the phrase love miles. All of us need to go somewhere to visit someone that we love that's going to just way ramp up our carbon footprint. So just think of them as love miles, and if it's not a love mile, try to find another way. You know, have your meeting over the phone, try to take the train, whatever you can do. So that 500 mile thing is kind of the
line. That's why I came by train from Minnesota.
Well,
here.
Congratulations.
Wow.
Okay, sir.
Is it known how many years until fuel cells will become the predominant means of energy?
No. I don't know. They're looking at all kinds of other stuff. People are trying to make fuel out of algae. Everything is fair game right now. So maybe we aren't even going to see fuel cells. But
okay.
Maybe something else is going to be.
My
family farm in Mount Vernon, my family farm. Okay, we're in a project now with a dairy farmer down the street and the local power company, the PUD, that the dairy farm at the end of the road. Somehow the cow manure is being converted into energy that's going out over lines that they had to build across the farms to catch up with where the main wire is. You can see, here's my English. No, there was a wire, it goes that way. And then also somehow magically, the dried manure after the energy has been taken out of it makes an excellent bedding material. So there's this whole sort of closed loop thing that's, it's not about fuel cells, it's about manure. So who knows what, I mean, maybe that'll be the answer to methane. When we were talking about that earlier, maybe, you know, the methane of cows is what's ending up in the power line that's being sold back to the utility. So we don't know.
Our point is eat less meat.
And eat less meat. Well, we didn't put that on there, but okay, we'll put that here. Eat less meat, yes, pretty much everybody agrees on that one. I think we have to go in a minute. I would just say, in my role as Pollyanna, asking you to confess your culpability, understand your power, and start looking for alternatives, I would cite, I've quoted Don in these sessions, because last winter I was here for the first time in the winter, and during the winter at Holden, a lot of staff time goes into stomping paths, you know, so other people can walk over them. And one day I was going from chalet to back to the dining room, and Don was walking sideways against the snowbank to make it wider, and it was like, Don, what are you doing? Well, it's all part of making the space for other people. So if you think anytime solar power on your church, whatever you can do, just think of yourself as stomping the trail, because the more space there is for alternatives, the more quickly we can maybe move away from these numbers and into something that's hopeful. We won't know its ultimate impact. We have to be prepared for the worst, but we can behave.